Mark chapter 2. Mark chapter 2. Verse 23. Mark says this, "And it happened that he was passing through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples began to make their way along while picking heads of grain. The Pharisees were saying to him, 'Look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?' Then he said to them, 'Have you never read what David did when he was in need and he and his companions became hungry? How he entered the house of God in the time of Abiathar, the high priest, and ate the consecrated bread, which is not lawful for anyone to eat except the priests. And he also gave it to those who were with him.' Jesus said to them, 'The Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath.'" Egyptian rat slap. Perhaps this is a game that many of you are familiar with and possibly enjoy. Yay? Nay? Egyptian rat slap. First time I was introduced to this game, I was overcome by how many rules there are and how on top of your game you need to be if you're going to compete. In fact, as I played, it seemed as if those I was playing with just continued to make up rules as we went along, as I would see hands start to fly in the middle and things start to happen and think, "You never told me about this." And so there was just all these kinds of rules. And I'm not a fast game player either. It takes my mind a second to wrap around what's actually happening in the world of the game. And so this is why I stay away from games such as Dutch Blitz or Speed or Nerds or any games like that, because things start happening, people start moving, all of a sudden people are standing up, and I'm sitting there thinking, "Oh, this isn't good." And then somebody calls out a word, and all of a sudden I'm like 40 points in the hole. And so I usually keep myself out of those circumstances. So Egyptian Rat Slap is a game like that for me because of the speed, but more so because of the long list of rules that one has to abide by. Listen to a few of these rules. So after you pass out the deck of cards, everybody's got their cards and they're going to go clockwise here. If there are ever double or sandwich of the same card, that is 2 8s or like 8 3 8, you slap the cards, and the one who slaps it first gets all the cards that have been played and puts them into their playing pile. The goal is to get all the cards and you win. Good, the rules continue. If you play a face card or an ace, so if you play a jack, the next person in order has one turn to play a face card. If he doesn't get one, the pile goes to the one who played the jack. Queen is 2 cards, king, 3 cards, ace, 4 turns to get a face card. If a person plays a face card or an ace in the allotted turns to do so, then it goes to the next person in order to try and get a face card or an ace until either there are doubles, sandwich, or no face card. Whoever gets the pile starts the next round. So many rules. I like war. Right? Somebody lays down a card, I lay down another card, I win. All right, let's move on. I play that with my daughter. She is a card person. She loves them. I don't like a lot of rules in games because I forget them. I think people like the Settlers of Catan game. A lot of Settlers players. That is a stressful, stressful day for me, playing the Settlers of Catan. So it makes it hard for me to enjoy playing it at all. And the truth is, nobody functions well under an overwhelming list of rules in any aspect of life, if you think about it. They weigh you down, they consume you, they take your focus off what it needs to be on. Now understand what I am not saying here. I am not saying that rules are unnecessary and that there is no need for them. It's simply untrue. We need rules. We need boundaries. And as believers, God has clearly lined out his precepts or his rules in his word for how we are to conduct our lives. Rules are necessary for things like driving, for things like sports, for households to function properly, for church functions, for the classroom. All of those things, rules are absolutely necessary. You need them. You have to have them. They're good things. But unnecessary rules, rules that go beyond what is prescribed, rules that are for the purpose of creating some form of true righteousness in a person, are not good. And that's what is happening in our text this morning. The Pharisees have placed some unnecessary burdens on the Jewish people concerning the Sabbath, and they attempt to place that burden on Jesus and his disciples. However, we will see that Jesus exposes their false, bankrupt religion of works, and he asserts his authority as Lord of the Sabbath, revealing to them explicitly that he is God. If you remember, this section falls in the midst of a number of conflicts between Jesus and the Pharisees. And in every one of those confrontations, Jesus reveals his authority in some way, and he is continually revealing his divinity to them. He's revealing the fact to them that he is God. Last time we saw that the conflict arose, Wednesday night with Brandon, arose due to the issue of fasting. And before that, the conflict came because of Jesus' compassion for sinners. And before that, it was based on Jesus' claim to forgive sins. And every one of these events that happened in Jesus' life and his disciples' life was creating this stir with the religious leaders of the day. They didn't like it. They were very much opposed to what was taking place. Over and over, Jesus is dealing with these religious people who are attempting to come to God on false pretenses and leading others to do the same by insisting on strict, outward, pious, unnecessary, man-made rules that were never prescribed and that were never intended by God. But as has been the case, Jesus will use this opportunity once again to declare his deity in our text. So I want you to note four events revolving around the issue of the Sabbath that point us to the reality of the deity of Christ. Four events revolving around the issue of the Sabbath that point us to the reality of the deity of Christ. And the first event is this. It is the misinterpreted commotion. The misinterpreted commotion in verse 23. Coming off the heels of Jesus' confrontation with the Pharisees over fasting, Mark says in verse 23, "And it happened." Now, we aren't certain how much time has passed, but as is characteristic in this gospel, Mark moves on to the next event that is going to emphasize the supreme authority of Christ to his Roman readers. And so he bounces around to these different scenes, to these different events in the life of Christ to emphasize the supreme authority of Christ over these things, and he wants his Roman readers to see that. And we know from the description of the setting in verse 23 that it was most likely early spring or somewhere between April and August. And we know this because that is when the grain that is referenced would have been edible. So sometime in the early spring or summer, Jesus and his disciples were walking, possibly to the synagogue, because it was the Sabbath. And it was Jesus' custom to do this. He would go and he would teach in the synagogue, especially on the Sabbath. That's what his custom was. As you look in the life of Christ, it's what he did every Sabbath. Well, notice the text says that they were walking through the grain fields. Now, I used to live next to countless grain fields. In fact, I would be in my office and I would look outside my window and just see grain. Grain as far as the eye could see. It was just innumerable amounts of grain. And one of the things I liked is, like, early when they first planted, actually you would look out and it looked like it was just grass. So you saw, like, green grass everywhere, because that's just how grain looked before it starts to do its thing and get ready to be harvested. But as it grows, you start to have big stalks, you have to have big plants of beans, and the corn stalks would get super tall, and all these things would happen. And you wouldn't find people just wandering through the grain fields. Like, if you know, a guy was out on his tractor and he saw somebody just wandering through his grain field this day and age, they're probably going to have a conversation. There's going to be a confrontation. That's not something that goes. He doesn't want the guy tracking over all of his plants and making his harvest no good because he's just walking all over and breaking all of his stems and all those kind of things. It's just not going to happen. And also, if you started walking in some of those cornfields, you would wander around until harvest because you'd be out there. There's acres and acres of corn, and I know I would. I'd be walking around in circles because I had no idea which direction I was in, and I would have to wait till the tractors come and take down all the grain to find my way out. So you don't have people just wandering through grain fields. It's just not what they do. However, in ancient Israel, this would have actually been the norm. Walking was the primary way to commute from village to village or from town to town. So as a result, pathways were made in the grain fields so that their walking commute would be shorter. So that's what they were doing. They were taking a shortcut through this particular grain field. As they were going, they were picking heads of grain to eat because they were hungry. So they were doing what was perfectly legit in this day and age. There were actual paths through these grain fields that they could walk on, and that's what it was intended for. So right before grain is to be harvested, you can actually pull off the head, the top part of the grain. You can crush the chaff between your fingers, and you will get like a little piece of grain. Just think of sunflower seeds. I like sunflower seeds, but I'm kind of guy who like just likes the saltiness, so I'll just stick a bunch in my mouth. And then the part of trying to get the seeds out becomes very annoying, and it gets stuck in my teeth, so I just spit all the seeds out after I get the saltiness I like. But think about that. You do all the work. You get into that little tiny seed. It's like first time I had crawdads and the last. First time I had crawdads, and you have to dig through this creature, all of his insides, for a piece of meat that is the size of a dime. Who does that? Unbelievable. Anyways, so that's so you're working through this grain, and you go through and you get this head, and you just pop it in your mouth, and you can eat the seed, and it's an edible piece of grain. About a year ago, my boys and I were invited to go dove hunting. So yes, I tell you how much I hate these things, but I have had some experiences. So I did. I went dove hunting. And so we go out, and I didn't have to go to the wilderness. I didn't have to camp. So I didn't have to do any of those things that just aren't going to happen. But he drives me in his truck, and we get on this dirt road. It's all on their property and everything, and we're going out. We get to shoot doves out of the air. That's pretty fun. I've always determined if I was going to go hunting and I could just shoot the animal, that'd be great. Having to gut it, clean it, eat it, don't want to do any of that. Just want to shoot it. Doves, you can just shoot those out of the air. That's fun stuff. So I'm there and ended up shooting a handful of doves, and my son got to shoot one, which was really quite fun. But while we were there, the guy with us, he was walking along, and some of the doves, when they'd come down, they were falling in this corn field, and it was super tall, and he would like wander back in there. But they would come out, and he would break the top of the corn off, and he was like eating it. And I thought that was weird, because I thought that corn was like all dried out and everything at that point. But that's exactly what the disciples were doing here. It was at that point they were able to break that little piece, probably corn, possibly wheat, break it off, and it was a kernel that they could chew on. Not like a popcorn kernel. Don't do that. You'll break your teeth. And so that's what they were doing. And when you hear that, as you're walking along someone else's grain field, you might be tempted to think, well, they're stealing. You know, they're stealing from this particular people. They're not supposed to be doing that. In fact, the Pharisees probably had a point when they called them out. They probably should have called them out on stealing. But that's not the case. They weren't stealing the grain. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 23 for just a second. It's very interesting, this law that the Lord decided to give to the nation of Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 25. It says, when you enter your neighbor's standing grain, so that's what the disciples were doing, then you may pluck the heads with your hand, but you shall not wield a sickle in your neighbor's standing grain. So in other words, you can't go in there with a thing and start whacking down the grain and taking it to harvest for yourself. You could go in there and you can, as you're walking through the grain fields, you can eat it. An interesting thing that the Lord established. But he was making provision for the needs of his people. Because walking was such a common thing, because they had to that's how they commuted, they're going to be hungry. And they didn't have a McDonald's that they could just stop at, which don't stop there. But they didn't have a McDonald's to stop at to eat. They had to pick heads of grain, and they would eat those, and that was kind of their snack, and it would keep them, it would sustain them. I think they would have to eat a lot to sustain them, as small as those seeds were, but nonetheless, that's what they would do. God made a provision for them while they were traveling. They weren't allowed to reap other people's fields, but they were permitted to eat their grain. Well, as you can see from the rest of the passage that I read, this causes quite a stir. Why? Well, because you look at verse 23, it says he was passing through the grain fields on the Sabbath. It was the Sabbath. The Pharisees, as we have seen thus far, made it their prerogative to follow Jesus and his disciples everywhere they went to try and catch him doing something that they could condemn him for and therefore disprove his authoritative claims. That was their entire point. That's what they wanted to do. They were like that pesky younger sibling who lives to get you in trouble. You had one of those? I was the pesky older sibling. I would love to get my siblings in trouble. When I was older, I would call my mom and act like I was somebody else and tell her some sort of wild thing about my brother. And she would be like, well, who are you? And why are you telling me this now? And, oh, he's going to be in big trouble. And I was like, yeah, that's awesome. So that's what these guys were like. They were just following Jesus around, and they were trying to catch him and basically tattle on him. Obviously, their purposes were greater in the sense they wanted to debunk everything he was saying. But the Sabbath for the Jewish people was the pinnacle of their week, especially the religious leaders. Now, this was a sacred day, and it was to be a sacred day. God did say it was to be a sacred day that was turned into a day where the Pharisees and other religious leaders could assert their control over the rest of the people in the name of holiness and piety. That's what it became. This day became the center of their works-based righteousness religious system. This happened frequently in their day, and it happens frequently in our day, that we take something good that God has created for his glory and our benefit and turn it into something corrupt and wicked. Don't we do that so often? God has made so many things in our world to be good, so many things that he has instituted and ordained to be good, and what do? We take them. Just as a overall big example, think of marriage. God ordained marriage to be this holy example, this holy picture of Christ in the church, and for there to be camaraderie and this companionship that is intimate and wonderful. God created that. In fact, it's the first thing he created. It's the first thing he instituted. And what have we done as a society and as a world? We've taken what God has created and turned it into something that is corrupt and filthy and wicked in so many ways. And that's what they did with the Sabbath. The Sabbath was instituted by God during the week that he created the world, as it says in Genesis 2:2. And after that, after he completed making the world on the seventh day, he rested. This day was intended to be a day of rest and worship under the old covenant. It was required to be kept by God when he gave Israel the law. Listen to Exodus 20, verse 8. He says, "Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy." Exodus chapter 31, 12 through 17 expounds on this command when it says, "The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, 'But as for you, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, you shall surely observe my Sabbaths, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. Therefore you are to observe the Sabbath, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death, for whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of complete rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall surely be put to death. So the sons of Israel shall observe the Sabbath, to celebrate the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the sons of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, but on the seventh day he ceased from labor, and it was refreshed, and was refreshed." In Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 12, Moses repeats his command as he is reminding Israel how they are to live as God's covenant people. He says, "Observe the Sabbath day and keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work. You or your son or your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, or your ox or your donkey, or any of your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you, so that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out of there by a mighty hand, by an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to observe the Sabbath day." This was a good gift instituted by God. God created man with a dependence upon rest, and therefore gave a Sabbath to man as a gift to fulfill that need. It was a good thing that God did. And God is worthy to be worshipped, as we rightly believe. And so he set aside a day where his people are to set their sights upon him and worship him. And he ordained that for the nation of Israel. And this was that day. This is what it was. It was to be holy unto the Lord. And his penalty for breaking the Sabbath was death. It was. It was a very holy and special day. But the Pharisees took this, and they ran with it, and they turned it into an avenue where they could flex their spiritual muscles. As a result of their blindness and clear misinterpretation, a commotion was made as the disciples were walking and eating grain. Well, this misinterpretation leads to a second event that points us in a direction of observing Christ's deity, and that is this: Number two, the misguided confrontation. The misguided confrontation in verse 24. As the Pharisees were tracking Jesus and his disciples' every move, they decided to pounce upon the perceived opportunity to trap Jesus. They saw it. Oh, you're walking through, you're eating heads of grain, you're working on the Sabbath. So we're gonna take this opportunity. Notice who it was the religious leaders approached. It wasn't the disciples, and if you look at the text, it says the disciples were the one who were picking heads of grain and eating it. It wasn't the disciples, but rather it was Jesus, their teacher. Now this was common for the teacher to be questioned because it was understood that the teacher was ultimately responsible for what his disciples were doing. And so when there was a confrontation in ancient Israel, they would go to the teacher and deal with him because he was responsible for his disciples. And that's what the Pharisees were doing here. The buck stopped with the teacher. And verse 24 says, they were saying to him, look. That word look carries the idea that they wanted Jesus to focus his attention very keenly upon his disciples and what they were doing, as if Jesus didn't know what they were doing, as if Jesus was just wandering around in his own world and not thinking about what he was supposed to be thinking about. And they said, look, Jesus, pay attention. Are you not even seeing this? Look what your disciples are doing. And then they ask their question. And this question that they ask exposes their blindness and their commitment to their man-made religion. Why are they, speaking of Jesus' disciples, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath? This was not a question of curiosity, as we've seen in every other text thus far dealing with the Pharisees, but it was a vindictive question. It was a question of condemnation. Look, Jesus, your disciples are clearly doing what is not prescribed in our Sabbath rules. What are you going to do about it? What do you have to say about it? That was what they were asking. They were accusing the disciples of breaking the law of the Sabbath, which, as you recall, God says is worthy of death. This is a strong accusation. This is an extremely strong accusation that they're making. And this begs the question, whose law are the Pharisees referring to? Obviously, if you were to ask them, they would say, God's law. It's God's law that we're referring to. God is the one who's ordained the Sabbath. God is the one who's given us rules to keep. God is the one who said, don't do any work on the Sabbath. But they had, because of their blindness and rejection of the truth and desire to control their religion, corrupted God's version of the law, and they had made their own version, which was right in their own eyes. They essentially had said, God, what you established in regard to the Sabbath didn't go far enough. Didn't go far enough, God. So we have modified it to make people conform outwardly to a standard which fits our religious system well. You didn't do what you were supposed to, God. You said keep the Sabbath and keep it holy, and you didn't go far enough. People don't know what that means. So we're gonna adapt that. We're gonna modify that. We're gonna put our swing on that. They were after the appearance of religion, which was outward conformity, while God was after true religion, which is inward transformation. Right, that's what the Pharisees were always after. They wanted to look right, and they wanted their people to look right. They wanted those who followed them to look right. Sometimes we can fall into that habit as parents. I know I can. I want my kids to look this particular way. I don't want people to look at my kids and say, whoa, he's a demon. You know, I don't want them to say that. You know, and thankfully my kids are my kids. I mean, they do their things. I have people coming to me and telling me what they're doing, and I'm like, I know. They're wicked and they're wretched and they need Christ. And so we'll discipline them and then we'll pray with them and beg the Lord to save them, because that's who they are. But sometimes we want to put this outward shell on them and say, look, they're perfect little angels. They're not. But that's what the Pharisees wanted to do with the Jewish people. With those people who were following them, they wanted to put their outward modification on these people so that they would be looked at and say, not look at those people who are holy, but look at their teachers who've made them holy. They wanted to be seen. Every instruction that God gave to his people was for the purpose of them demonstrating their love for him and drawing the pagan nations to him, but it was never for the purpose of earning his favor. Sometimes people get confused in the Old Testament. They think, well, God has given all these laws and they were to keep those, and if they didn't keep those, they weren't going to be saved. No. God has always been a God who transforms hearts, and then the demonstration of obedience takes place. God didn't have a different way of salvation for the Old Testament, for them to keep the law, and that's how they were saved. Their keeping of the law in the Old Testament was their sanctification. It was showing their love for God. It was a demonstration of their love for God, and it was an opportunity for them to say to the nations, look, we love this God who has saved us. We love this God who has called us out of Egypt, who has given us this new life. That's what it was for. But the Pharisees took that and turned that, turned it into something where they were earning favor with God. I want you to listen to this commentator's lengthy description of the Pharisees' version of the law, which was imposed on people. I've read some of this kind of stuff before, but this was pretty eye-opening for me. Almost no area of life was spared from the fastidious Sabbath regulations of the rabbis, which were designed to gain God's favor. There were laws about wine, honey, milk, spitting, writing, and getting dirt off clothes. Anything that might be contrived as work was forbidden. Thus, on a Sabbath, scribes could not carry their pens, tailors their needles, or students their books. To do so might tempt them to work on the Sabbath. For that matter, carrying anything heavier than a dried fig was forbidden. And if the object in question had been picked up in a public place, it could only be set down in a private place. If the object were tossed into the air, it had to be caught with the same hand. To catch it with the other hand would constitute work and therefore be a violation of the Sabbath. No insects could be killed. That wouldn't be good for me. I love to kill all insects. No candle or flame could be lit or extinguished. Nothing could be bought or sold. No bathing was allowed, which is disgusting, since water might spill onto the floor and accidentally wash it. No furniture could be moved inside the house since it might create ruts in the dirt floor and thereby constitute plowing. An egg could not be boiled even if all one did was place it in the hot desert sand. A radish could not be left in salt because it would become a pickle and pickling constituted work. Sick people were only allowed enough treatment to keep them alive. Any medical treatment that could improve their condition was considered work and therefore prohibited. It was not even permissible for women to look in the mirror, been a rough day, since they might be tempted to pull out any gray hairs they spotted. Nor were they allowed to wear jewelry, since jewelry weighs more than a dried fig. Other activities that were banned on the Sabbath included washing clothes, dyeing wool, shearing sheep, spinning wool, tying or untying a knot, sowing seed, plowing a field, reaping a harvest, binding sheaves, threshing wheat, grinding flour, kneading dough, hunting a deer, or preparing its meat. One of the more interesting restrictions is related to the distance people could travel on the Sabbath. A person was not allowed to travel more than 3,000 feet from home or to take more than 1,999 steps. This was before the days of Fitbits and Garmins and iPhones that count your steps, so you would have to keep in mind how many steps you want. Due to practical concerns, the rabbis devised creative ways to get around this. If one placed food at the 3,000-foot point before the Sabbath began, that point was considered an extension of one's home, thereby enabling a person to travel another 3,000 feet. Or if a rope or a piece of wood was placed across a narrow street or alley, it was considered a doorway, making it part of one's home and allowing the 3,000 feet of travel to begin there. Even in modern times, Jewish neighborhoods connect houses together using cords or ropes known as an eruv. Doing so, from the perspective of rabbinic law, creates a single home out of every connected building, allowing people to move freely within the defined area without being limited to the 3,000-foot restriction and to carrying certain household items like keys, medicine, strollers, canes, and babies. Unbelievable. I mean, if you paid any attention at all listening to those things, you're thinking, that is absolutely out of control. And as I was looking at that and reading through that, that's what I was thinking. How absurd, how stupid, how terrible is that? What? How could you possibly take what God said and turn it into that? And that's what the Pharisees had in mind when they asked this question. When they said, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath? They had that in mind. This is the epitome of legalism. They were imposing man-made rules upon themselves and others for the purpose of what? For the purpose of gaining favor with God. And as ridiculous as this sounds, and as idiotic as this is, because it is, and there's no other way to describe it, it is ridiculous. Do we ever do this? You might be thinking, never in a million years have I ever thought about those things, and doing those things, and imposing those restrictions on other people. But do we ever even subtly try and impose that which is an issue of conscience upon ourselves and others because we think in some way it is more holy and gains us greater favor with God? Do we do this? I think we do. Things like the issue of homeschooling versus public and private school. Has that not, for many Christians, become an issue to where if you don't do one of those particular things, you're not as holy as we are? Or the issue of dating versus courting. Is that not an issue that has caused some families to say that if you don't do it this way, you're not under the same favor of God as we are? They would never say those words. You would never say those words. I would never say those words. But don't we think that? When we think about some people doing something a certain way, then we think, I would never do it that way. And why? Well, I'm better than that. I'm not going to do that. They obviously aren't as sanctified as I am in my understanding of things. I think we do this often. I think we adapt this attitude way more often than we would think. I mean, we would never do it with such things as we read, but with these things? Is it not our tendency to take these types of things and turn them into commands that must be followed if you are a good Christian? I think we do that. We need to be careful with these types of things because, in essence, that is exactly what the Pharisees were doing. They were adding to what God said to better fit their skewed way of thinking, and that's what we must avoid. They were adding to it. Well, their misguided confrontation leads to a third event in our text, which points us in the direction again of observing Christ's deity, and that is this, the model correction. The model correction in verse 25 and 26. Jesus answers them and thus corrects their misguided and corrupt accusations with an illustration from the Old Testament. His statement at the beginning of verse 25, have you never read, exposes their ignorance of the principles taught in the Old Testament. He then gives them a synopsis of an event involving David to drill his point home. And this event is found in 1 Samuel 21, if you turn there with me for just a second. This is the first six verses of 1 Samuel 21. This is the event that Jesus is alluding to. It says, then David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, why are you alone and no one is with you? David said to Ahimelech the priest, the king has commissioned me with a matter and said to me, let no one know anything about the matter which I am sending to you, which I have commissioned you, and I have directed the young men to a certain place. There now therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found. And the priest answered David and said, there's no ordinary bread on hand, but there is consecrated bread, if only the young men have kept themselves from women. David answered the priest and said to them, surely women have been kept from us as previously when I set out and the vessels of the young men were holy, though it was an ordinary journey. How much more than today will their vessels be holy? So the priest gave them the consecrated bread, for there was no bread but the bread of the presence, which was removed from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away. So what's happening here? Well, David and his men were fleeing from Saul. Remember, he did that a lot in these in these chapters because Saul wanted to kill him, so he left. And he ended up at the temple of Nob, and him and his men were in desperate need of some food. They were famished. They had not eaten. They were in the desert, and so they needed to eat. And so they go into this temple, and it says that Ahimelech gave them the showbread to eat and be sustained. Well, point of clarification is necessary here, because as you look at your text, Jesus says that Abiathar was the high priest, and 1 Samuel says that Ahimelech was the high priest when this happened. So does the Bible contradict itself here? I don't think so. The Bible never contradicts itself. So what's the solution? Well, there are different options. It's possible that both Abiathar and Ahimelech, who were father and son, went by both names. This was somewhat common in this day. Another option, which is what we see translated in our English Bibles, is that this happened in the time of Abiathar the high priest, which was a perfectly acceptable way of referring to a time period, especially if the son was more popular and well known, which Abiathar was. And so that's how they would announce certain things. And so he said in the time of Abiathar, he was more known than Ahimelech. And so Jesus announces it that way, and I think that's probably the best option. So David and his men ended up there in this temple, and the high priest gave them the bread that was only for the priests to eat. This bread was the leftover showbread. You see, every Sabbath, loaves of bread would be put out, or it's called the bread of the presence. It would be put on, it would be set out by the high priest on the gold table in the holy place as an act of worship. It was set out as a thing of worship to God. It was what they did. Well, after 7 days, the priests were then allowed to eat the bread. And because of their need, Ahimelech made an exception and showed compassion on David and his men and gave them the consecrated bread. Well, why does that matter? Kind of a weird example. Well, notice that David was not condemned for this action. And the Pharisees knew that. They knew that David and his men were not condemned for this. They were never condemned by God. They were never condemned by the people. And they also revered David for being a man after God's own heart. You know, they revered Moses, they revered David, they revered Abraham. Anything these guys did was gold to them. They could do no wrong. So what was Jesus getting at with this illustration? He was using an argument from the lesser to the greater that they would understand, as well as calling out the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. The argument is this: since David, who you revere and do not condemn for this practice, gave some bread to his companions, who you also don't condemn, how much more should you not condemn the God-man and his disciples for breaking your man-made law? That's the argument he's using. That's what he's saying to them. And they would have understood that because they revered David. And so what's Jesus doing? He's putting himself higher than David. He's showing again, he's starting to reveal his deity to them. God allowed a ceremonial law to be broken for the sake of meeting an urgent human need. You see, God's intention was never for ceremony to stand in the way of kindness and goodness toward others. That was never his intention. The hypocritical Pharisees had kept the letter of the law and added to it, as we have seen, but they missed the spirit of the law, which reflects God's goodness and kindness toward his people. Well, this leads us finally to the fourth event, which declares Christ's deity, and that is this. Number four, the majestic conclusion. The majestic conclusion in verses 27 and 28. After explaining to them their misguided understanding of the Sabbath, Jesus expounds on the purpose of the Sabbath. It was not, as the Pharisees had made it, to be a day of relentless restriction for the production of outward piety, but rather, Jesus says, the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. Jesus was saying that the Sabbath came into being for the purpose of benefiting man. That's why God ordained it. That's why God instituted it. God ordained it to give man a day of rest after his 6 days of work, and this was turned into an insurmountable burden by the Pharisees. The Sabbath was to be a day of spiritual reflection and worship, as well as a day of physical renewal. That was the purpose. The Pharisees, by their actions, had deceived themselves into believing that they created the Sabbath for the purpose of gaining favor with God. But as the second half of verse 27 says, man was not made for the Sabbath. This means that people were not created as slaves to the ritual and ceremonial observance of the Sabbath. That's not why we were created. The Pharisees had turned the true purpose of the Sabbath on its head and created a corrupt religious system. Well, note verse 28, because it is Christ's climactic statement of this text. He says, so or therefore, for this reason, the Son of Man, that is the ultimate man, the God-man, Jesus, has absolute authority over the Sabbath, which was instituted by God. So what was he saying? He's saying, I rule the Sabbath because I ordained the Sabbath because I am God. That's what he was saying to these Pharisees. And Jesus again reveals himself to these religious leaders as the God of the universe, the Lord over all creation. And this means for them that he is worthy of their worship and their devotion and their obedience. However, as we will see in the next passage, they reject him as God in our anger to the point of seeking to destroy him. So they go from being frustrated with him, trying to debunk the fact that he's an authoritative teacher, to the point of wanting to destroy him. You see it escalate in this next passage. But his message to them is loud and clear, and yet because of the blindness of their sin, they reject him. He says, I am Lord of the Sabbath. I am God standing in your midst right now. And yet because of the blindness of their sin, because of the hardness of their heart, and it speaks to how deadly sin is and how much of a bind and hold that it has on a person, because God is standing in their midst telling them who he is, and they reject him out of hand. What about you this morning? Jesus has revealed himself loud and clear in this text as the God-man, as God in the flesh. Have you responded appropriately to him as he demands, through repentance and belief? Do you worship him as the divine Son of God? And if you say you do, does your life reflect that worship that comes from your mouths? Because he's worthy of that. Well, as we close this morning, I want to give a few implications from this text, so that the Holy Spirit can apply it to each of our personal situations. The first implication is this: seeking to gain favor with God through obedience is legalism. Seeking to gain favor with God through obedience is legalism. How do we gain favor with God? We don't. God grants favor because of his Son. See, Jesus gained the favor of God. Jesus was the perfect man. Jesus went to the cross and died the perfect death. And because of that perfection, because of that obedience, God favors those who come to him through Christ. And so any attempt to gain favor with God through obedience is legalism. Secondly, seeking to be righteous by adding to what God has prescribed in his word is legalism. When we seek to add to what God has said, when we seek to do those things because we don't think what God has said is enough, it's legalism. Third, placing a burden upon another person with regard to man-made rules or regulations to follow them, to be spiritual, is legalism. Placing a burden upon another person with regard to man-made rules or regulations to follow them, to be spiritual, is legalism. That's not how we become spiritual. You don't make someone spiritual by giving them rules to follow. Fourth, that the Sabbath has been fulfilled. Its ordained principles of rest and spiritual rejuvenation still remain. God has still given us a day. We call it the Lord's Day. It was instituted in the book of Acts. The first day of the week is when the church began to meet. It's what we do this morning. We gather for the purpose of worshiping God together. We take the day to worship God together, and so we still need to understand those principles remain of rest and spiritual rejuvenation. Fifth, finally, Christ's authority over the Sabbath signifies his deity. As a result, he has full authority over his church and over our lives as individuals, and therefore we must submit to him as Lord. Because Christ is Lord of the Sabbath, he's Lord of our lives. And he calls the shots. And our only response, the only right response, the only response that he'll accept is submission. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your kindness to us. Thank you for your word. Thank you, Lord, for revealing this truth to our hearts. Lord, as we battle with different things in our own human flesh and and struggle sometimes to want to gain favor with you that has already been granted by Christ, Lord, I pray that we would see that and that we would rest in Christ and that we would obey you fully because we love you and because you have given us life. Lord, thank you for your word. Thank you that we can bow before you and submit to you. I pray that that's what happens in our lives this morning. In Christ's name, amen.